May it please the court, Your Honor, I'm calling for Z registration 25452. Counsel, guests, clerk works at the back. This case, in the amount of time that I have, I'm going to focus on really the first two issues because they are so intertwined and they are, especially the second, a completely unique set of circumstances to Colorado case law. The issue in this case is, and it's never been in dispute, that one has the absolute right to have counsel and the absolute right to counsel of your choice and the right to have conflict-free counsel. And in this case, there's no doubt, even by the attorney regulation, the former head for 8 years, who said this was as egregious a case as he's seen in his expert opinion, and the other with both real and actual, real and indirect conflict the entire time due to what was created by Mr. Alan Cowan. The first issue, though, is what did he have the right to have conflict-free counsel? Does he have the right to fire his own attorney? And does he have the right to have another attorney come in of his choosing? A lot of the case law focuses on somebody who has a public defender or a court-appointed attorney because of a conflict and is trying to fire them at the last minute. The courts are very clear. You don't have an absolute right to always have the attorney of your choice. You can't do it if it's going, you can't fire someone if the sole purpose is really to come in and play games, delay the inevitable. And that's what the case law always speaks to. The case that's clearly on point in this is Brown. The lower court, when focusing on the issue and had a hearing on whether Mr. Robinson had the right to fire his attorney, focused on almost an Aguello kind of case where if you have the right to fire your public defender and represent yourself, what is the standard? What are the rights that you have? And that was not the case in this set of facts and circumstances.
Well, wasn't it pretty close? I mean, what the court here found was, number one, it was very late in the day when your client asked to, you know, said, I'm having all kinds of problems with my counsel. There was also some record support for the argument that the consultant advised your counsel, your client, to wait, raise the issue at the last minute, and tank the proceedings. Those weren't the exact words, but it was kind of colloquial like that. And that's what the court found. I mean, and the court also said this all looks strategic. What you're raising was you didn't like which witnesses the lawyer was calling, you didn't like this, didn't like that, none of which rise to the usual level we see of an actual conflict of interest or something like that. I guess I'm having a little trouble, Mr. Rizzi, understanding where's the conflict and where did the court get it wrong on those facts?
Sure. A couple things. First off, what the court didn't do is the court didn't make much of a record. Because what's clearly under not just the Brown, but all the cases that follow up to it, and I believe the court's quote was, I haven't had time to look at the case law, but, and if the court may actually recall, one of the things that was most interesting is how the court, the lower court, deferred to the attorney and said, I don't know how to do this. What do you think? And she is saying, well, you need to put him under oath. Do I really? Yes. Well, okay, then I'll do that. And then says to Ms. Miller, can you tell me what you need to say? Oh, I can't. You have to ask me a series of questions. It's only a limited. Oh, okay, I didn't know how this works. I mean, that's really how things went. As far as the actual prejudice, let's make clear, it's not just, and that's what Ms. Miller only focused on because that's what the court only inquired about. The court only made inquiry about issues about witnesses. Unfortunately, what the court didn't inquire is when he said, I'm not comfortable, I'm not feeling prepared, I've just gotten a bunch of transcripts that I've finally been able to print out on Monday, 1 week before the trial.
But the court made a finding they were sent a long time earlier, and your client just had some issue printing them out.
Right.
How does that raise the conflict of interest? The concern I'm, of course, asking is the precedent. I'm concerned that, you know, we see cases where some are strong conflicts of interest. I'm representing a witness for the government, in another case. That's a conflict. Here, the issues you just raised, I'm having trouble seeing how that gives rise to something so strenuous that it created a conflicted counsel.
Great question. For example, one of the issues about the transcripts was Mr. Robinson said that he had given a list of witnesses that he wanted her to interview for the second trial. She hadn't done any of it. Mr. Robinson said, the reason why I need the printout of the transcripts is because just over a week before trial, a week and a half before trial on the Friday, my attorney told me to print out the transcripts and give them to the witnesses to review. He's saying, shouldn't that be her job to meet with the witnesses? Shouldn't she be talking to them about the testimony? And he tried to print it out, and as the court clearly can see, not just from the way that he is articulating, but also from the simple fact, he's not an educated man. He is an uneducated man with not even a high school degree. He has a GED that he did an online course of. So this is an uneducated man, and that's exactly what the Sixth Amendment says we need to protect. somebody that doesn't. This is not a level playing field between the government and somebody with no legal experience. And in this case, when he's saying, I wanted her to interview these witnesses, she's refusing to do it. I'm now having to print off transcripts that I don't know how to print off. He doesn't know how to use a computer. I'm trying to figure out how to print this stuff off, deliver it to my witnesses less than a week before trial, and she hasn't talked to them. And unfortunately, when the court made its inquiries, all it focused on was simply a couple of the witness issues. One of the very fundamental issues. I'm not comfortable with her. I don't think I'm prepared. I haven't had time to prepare. She's refusing to meet with me the way she used to meet with me. I know that I'm not comfortable. And insightfully, he said, I know that if I'm forced to go to trial, guess what? I know I'm going to be convicted because I am so unprepared. And he was right.
But let me ask you this. What needs to be shown? I mean, does there need to be shown an actual conflict when you're looking at whether your client was dissatisfied with counsel, or is it just mere dissatisfaction? I mean, aren't there two different standards here? Because my understanding is we're looking at the factors identified in Brown, whether right. a continuance would be warranted.
Well, we should have been looking. The court, unfortunately, didn't make inquiries under one of the factors that the case law had said, which was the Brown inquiry. The court chose not to make any of those factors and findings. The court was only worried about, as it continually said, the only thing I'm worried about is the effectiveness of justice. When are we going to get the trial done? The court only looked at the trial court's calendar. For example, it never said, you know, the people cited inconvenience of witnesses, as the case law says. Oh, we just have to re-subpoena them. Prosecutor defense a lot of time. We always have to re-subpoena witnesses. But that's not prejudice. That's just merely inconvenience. In this case, the court didn't make an inquiry about, well, this is our docket, this is the calendar, this is when. One of the inquiries is supposed to be, what actual steps have you done to obtain a new attorney? Mr. Robinson would have been able to tell him, I've talked to several attorneys. I've talked to some even out of state. Some have reviewed the transcripts. I provided them as much information as I could. None of them are available. He did articulate, nobody is available for trial next week. Obviously insinuating, I've talked to other lawyers and they're not available. What unfortunately the court didn't say is who, what, when, where, how long have you been talking? The court chose not to look at any of these factors that the case law says is supposed to be ruled upon.
All right. Well, and let me just go back to another one of the factors. So getting back to my other question is, when we're looking at the dissatisfaction of the client and the concern whether client has raised dissatisfaction earlier, is that all that needs to be identified as dissatisfaction, or do you have to actually identify that there is a conflict?
Well, again, go back to 1963, Gideon Wainwright. It's a case-by-case basis. The court can't make a one-size-fits-all of, well, if somebody says they're dissatisfied. The issue is that's exactly why this court is supposed to make it. You don't have the absolute right, but you're just making sure that they're not moving this continuance for an improper purpose. And that's all the case law has ever said. And so, no, that's exactly what this court and every court is now required to have done that they did not do. They didn't find out if he was just doing it as a gamesmanship timed delay or if it's something he truly felt he had a conflict with. He articulated all these reasons, and then the court, upon inquiry, Ms. Miller, only asked about three witnesses. And as he aptly pointed out, I've just thrown my lawyer under the bus. Now she's supposed to represent me like next week on a life sentence case. Right, I've articulated all these reasons. You only asked about witnesses. And what was very clear is Ms. Miller said, you know, I think we can work this out. It's like a husband and wife getting a divorce, and the wife coming in and saying, we have an irreconcilable difference, I want a divorce, and the court looking at the husband saying, you think he can work this out? The issue is it's his right.
And but the problem, Mr. Brzee, and I know you're an experienced lawyer, and you can appreciate, we see this all the time, more often in a 35C, you know, where we get the, my lawyer did this, my lawyer did that. And many, the courts take a hard look. And here, as I recall it, Ms. Miller said, I can represent this gentleman. I'm sure she's been on the side of similar attacks. And so if we create a rule that says, as soon as the client says, I'm really, really unhappy with my lawyer, she's done a lousy job, that the court has to appoint substitute counsel, even if it's raised the week before, the system would fall apart.
Absolutely would. And that's why it's supposed to be a case by case. But he didn't come in there saying, you know, gee, shucks, I just don't like her. I'm not comfortable. He's saying, we haven't met. I'm not prepared. My family isn't prepared. Nobody's prepared. None of the witnesses. I have witnesses that I have given her the name and number they haven't even spoken to yet. I have witnesses that I think is necessary for my defense after reading the transcript that she's not talking to me about. And we haven't interviewed them. We haven't subpoenaed them. They haven't reviewed the transcript. One of them was actually his stepbrother who was living in the residence at the time, a double wife. And he was an actual witness. There were five people in the double wide at the time. She never even bothered to try to talk to him. And she said, well, my understanding is he doesn't have much of a memory. But again, this is her. You know, ironically, that's exactly what the attorney in Ragusa said. I think I could still represent her. And that's the pivotal case. I spoke to Mr. Albany, who was the attorney, who was the one that was the conflict from the Ragusa case. And that's the folly or the problem that he made. It's not his right. It's the defendant's right. And he can't get up there and say, the moment the client, I mean, in Ragusa, the big issue that the court was concerned about is, aren't we opening up the floodgate again? And the answer is, when there is a conflict, and the client feels that there is a conflict, and can articulate reasons other than just, geez, I wish things had been done differently. In this case, you know, when I'm having to run around and deliver transcripts to witnesses that she hasn't talked to, and I can't even figure out how to print them, and we're less than a week before trial, we've got a problem. The court chose to not ask anything about that. And that's the problem. Had the court made a more thorough record, which ironically would have been made when we filed a motion for a new trial, that the court initially said, I will give you as much time as you want, and we set out a four-hour block. And then what happened? The court, prior to the hearing, summarily ruled a written order without giving us the hearing that it said at the time of sentencing it would give to us. And ironically, we now can't go back and recreate that record because the trial consultant, Alan Cowan, died. Right, we had him under, he was coming in to testify for that hearing, and now he can't. He was amenable to it. Everybody knows he was agreeable to coming in to testify, and he was planning on flying in. We were going to, of course, have to pay for it, and that's the problem. And nor does this case stand for the fact that if somebody reads something on the internet, they can say, oh, unauthorized practice of law, I automatically have the right to do an appeal. This is a very unique set of circumstances where, you know, in this day and age with the economy the way it is, people are going to prey upon nervous, scared individuals, no more so than this.
Mr. Bissi, you just mentioned a minute ago that there's conflict. You used the word conflict, and it's coming back to Judge Lichtenstein's question. How do you define conflict when you're using that word? In Ragusa, the issue, of course, was in-camera hearings where, I mean, they totally threw their client under the bus. They tell the court in-camera with the client not sitting there, you know, we told him to take the deal. He's not listening to us. And the court said, that's obviously a conflict. You're trying to preserve your own reputation or whatever with the court. I get how that's an actual conflict of interest in the legal sense. When you say conflict, what are you talking about?
Are you talking about with regards, well, for example, with Mr. Cowan, when he's saying things such as, your client, your attorney is an idiot. You absolutely have to testify. To which he then informs his attorney, I'm going to testify in the second case. Not only that, he's saying, you have to testify perfectly. That individual flew in, met with, after reviewing the transcripts, met with Mr. Robinson and helped coach him to get him ready for the second trial.
But where's the conflict with Ms. Miller? I mean, where are her interests divergent from your client's? That's what I'm not getting.
So there's two different issues. One is
what, I'm sorry.
I apologize. One is what the court didn't make the app inquiry about at the onset. The second is with Alan Cowan. The first issue is he talked about, you know, the lack of preparedness that he was, how he was doing it, and not just strategy of what witnesses are we calling in what order. She's not willing to call witnesses. She's not willing to meet with witnesses. She's not willing to talk to witnesses. I gave her a list of witnesses I want her to do. That's her job. She hasn't even called them, spoken to them, talked to them, made inquiry. We're a week from trial, less than. That's your actual conflict. I mean, she's not doing the job. And in the other case, the actual conflict is when he's saying things, Alan Cowling is saying things to Don Robinson of, you, the conflict is, you have to testify. You're going to do this. You can't fire your attorney yet. I'll tell you when you fire your attorney. I'll write your motion for you. I'll tell you what to say. Oh, and by the way, when they offered you the plea agreement that she was advising you to take, what did you, Mr. Cowling say? Absolutely not. You can't do it. And Mr. Robinson, in response to Mr. Cowling, the next day turned around and wrote no on it and gave it back to Ms. Miller.
And counsel knew nothing about the consultant's involvement.
I was the first one that told her the news.
So how does counsel have a conflict if she doesn't even know this guy's out there scurrying around?
Again, the initial conflict was what was done with what was done at the hearing that the court didn't make apt inquiry about. The second is the actual conflict with Mr. Cowling, and the issue is the unauthorized practice of law impinges upon his right to have conflict-free counsel. And whether she knows about it or not is not what matters, whether there's conflict-free counsel. And the issue is that's exactly who the court needs to protect, somebody that doesn't know any better, that's preyed upon of, hey, here's what you're going to do. Hey, here's how it's going to work. I'm the one. Don't tell your lawyer. If that's the case, this doesn't stand for something I've read. This stands for somebody that's manipulating the entire system.
Did the trial court know about Mr. Was the trial court told about Mr. Cowling?
The trial court was told about Alan Cowling after the conviction, after the jury came back with a verdict prior to the sentencing. All of this was explained and articulated in, I believe, 148-page motion with multiple attachments, including an attachment from multiple attachments from the attorney regulation
practice investigator. But the court was not told before trial when you were trying to get a substitution.
Correct. Neither the court knew about what was going on with Alan Cowling, nor did his attorney, Ms. Miller, know about what was going on until after the conviction. Ms. Miller was stunned why some of his answers were completely different than the first time, because that's how Alan Cowling had coached him to testify.
All right, thank you. Your time's up.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Jillian Price, registration number 40815, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. This court should affirm Mr. Robinson's convictions because none of his claims are meritorious. With respect to the motion to continue and the alleged conflicted counsel claim, these claims have no support in either the law or in fact. Now, under People v. Muncy, 232 P3rd 113, a defendant need not show good cause to fire his retained counsel. Indeed, a defendant is free to discharge his or her retained counsel without having to show good cause, as long as the discharge is not made for improper purposes and does not significantly disrupt judicial proceedings. Here, Mr. Robinson's request was indeed made for improper purposes and would have significantly disrupted judicial proceedings. Although the trial court could not have known about this at the time, the record is very clear that Mr. Robinson made his request for continuance based on motivations to, quote, get the proceedings shut down. That is a quote that was articulated in Mr. Robinson's motion for new trial, trial court record page 556, paragraphs 13 through 16. The trial consultant advised Mr. Robinson to get the proceedings shut down and to string his trial counsel along in order to get transcripts. Clearly, this is a dilatory move aimed at disrupting the proceedings, and as such, this court should affirm the trial court's denial of the motion for continuance. Additionally, the facts that the trial court knew at the time were adequate to support its denial of the motion to continue. Mr. Robinson's motion was made 4 days before trial. He requested an open-ended continuance, and he did not indicate that he had new counsel waiting in the wings, which was the case in People v. Brown. He did not wish to proceed pro se. He did not claim that he was indigent. There's no evidence that he would have even been able to find a new attorney. The prejudice to the people was also great. This was approximately a two-week trial, probably more like a week and a half. There were 20 witnesses. The victim herself was a child, and several of the other witnesses were children. This was also the second trial of this matter. Under these circumstances, granting a motion for continuance for the reasons that Mr. Robinson articulated would have been improper.
Ms. Price, I believe that Mr. Breese was stating that those factors would go to only mere inconvenience and nothing, no other prejudice was shown. And what would be your response to that?
Well, my response to that is there would have been actual prejudice to the people. Mr. Breese in his brief makes a conclusory statement that this was mere inconvenience, but he has not demonstrated how rescheduling a week and a half trial with 20 witnesses, many of whom are children, including the victim herself, would have been a mere inconvenience. The trial court said on the record that it has a very, very full document, as did the attorneys. This would be a minimum of a six-month continuance. Mr. Robinson, there was some indication that he would waive speedy trial. This was not a case that could have been simply rescheduled in another week. This would have been a massive undertaking. That is prejudice to the people. Now, on the converse, Mr. Robinson would have to show actual prejudice as a result of the denial of his continuance, and he has not done that here. regardless of the strategic conflicts that he alleged with his trial counsel, which again do not rise to the level where a motion to continue should be granted, or a motion for new trial for a new counsel for that matter. His attorney had the benefit of hearing the evidence through the first trial. She had ample time to develop her strategy, to fine-tune it, to hone it. She made adequate opening and closing statements. She vigorously cross-examined witnesses. She made motions before the second trial. She made objections during the trial. There's no evidence in the record that Mr. Robinson was actually prejudiced because he had to stick with his retained trial counsel here.
Ms. Price, can I shift gears on you completely, because I want to make sure you get a chance to address an issue that I'm just going to tell you straight up bothers me. And this is the expert issue. The expert, before trial, as I understand it, you can correct me on the facts, the court issued a ruling that the expert was not going to be allowed to give an opinion, you know, along the lines of, you know, only 1-3% of children lie about a sexual abuse or something like that. Court excluded that. The expert testified about it anyway. I recognize the court attempted to cut the expert off and gave a curative instruction. How is that? The court said, I'm not letting this in because it's highly, highly prejudicial. It amounts to an opinion on the witness, the victim's credibility and truth-telling. How do you put that genie back in the bottle? I mean, I have affirmed convictions on the ground, you know, curative instruction, we assume the jury follows instruction and all that. I'm just going to be very candid with you. This one bothers me. I mean, the court correctly said before a trial how prejudicial this is. I recognize the prosecutor didn't sound like the prosecutor did anything wrong here. I mean, this is the expert who decided to take it on herself to testify to what she knew she was not allowed to. I don't know how you put the genie back in this bottle, and I'm very, very concerned about it. Would you address that issue?
Absolutely. My position is that the genie was never let out of the bottle, and this is why. What the witness says, and this is from the 71910 transcript at page 178, the jury asks a question, based on your experience and expertise, can you explain why a child might falsely accuse a parent? The witness says, it is very rare for false allegations to occur. The research indicates that only 1-3% of all child, the court says, wait, stop. I don't think a genie has been let out of the bottle at that point. Now, I agree with you. This was incorrect testimony for the witness to give based on the trial court's ruling. That was a ruling that was made pre-trial. And this was a question that came from the jury, not from counsel. Given that that this testimony was very brief, given that the evidence against Mr. Robinson was overwhelming, I don't believe that a genie was let out of the bottle, especially in light of, again, the witness being cut off, the trial court giving a curative instruction, and the evidence of Mr. Robinson's guilt being truly overwhelming.
So I get maybe the witness didn't get out the 1-3%, but the witness got out very few children lie. I mean, I assume this witness, I looked at pieces of the record, I assume this witness was a pretty important witness. I don't know if there were other experts in the case. I mean, we all know, you know, folks who try cases, jurors put a lot of faith in experts. That's the concern. So this expert managed to say very, very few people, children lie. And I don't know. That's true. So you say the genie didn't get out. That genie got out. And I'm just not, you know, why does the curative instruction, how do we know that the curative instruction solved that problem? How do we know that the jurors aren't, you know, taken back to the room? Gee, that very credible expert said very few children lie.
Well, the trial court's curative instruction was made immediately, for one thing. The trial court said disregard the answer. The transcript says in its entirely, obviously that's a typo, to that particular question, set it aside. I mean, this happens immediately. The trial court says disregard this in its entirety.
Is there any, what case would require a mistrial? I'm embarrassed, I'm not remembering the case where someone makes an allusion to someone going to do a drug run to Missouri. It's one of the more famous cases, and the court said mistrial in that case. I'm familiar from personal experience with cases where, you know, where you're dealing with in-building asbestos cases, and someone mentions the one-time mention of the word cancer, got a mistrial because there was no personal injury in the case. When do you get a mistrial in a case like this, notwithstanding a curative instruction? Can you give me an example?
Perhaps in a case that you just, I'm not familiar with the Missouri case that you just referenced, I apologize, but perhaps in a case where the evidence is not as overwhelming as it was here, perhaps where an expert testified to a piece of evidence for which there is no other support in the case, perhaps as you mentioned in a case where we're talking about asbestos and cancer, no one else has ever mentioned cancer, and here we have it. That might be a red flag. To the contrary, here in this case, we have the victim's testimony herself. The victim's brother is also testifying, you know what? Yeah, I saw Dad in my sister's room. She didn't have any clothes on. He didn't have any clothes on. There is truly, truly strong and overwhelming evidence of Mr. Robinson's guilt in this case. And under these circumstances of this case, the expert's testimony that, you know, it's rare for false allegations to occur was minimal, it was innocuous, and that would not inflame the jury's passions or cause them to decide this case on anything but the evidence, which clearly states that Mr. Robinson was guilty of sexually assaulting a child, his daughter.
All right.
Well, when you're discussing the evidence that you are stating is overwhelming, does it make a difference whether the evidence would be physical evidence corroborating the child's statements or not? I mean, I'm just looking at, when we're looking at overwhelming, and I understand that defense counsel here was saying this is really a he said, she said type of case. Does that make a difference? Does it make a difference when it's a type of case where there's physical corroboration? And was this one of those cases?
Well, as Your Honor knows, direct and circumstantial evidence, you know, is obviously given the same weight. And I think here, perhaps Your Honor is referring to the DNA evidence on certain objects that were located in this case, and that was inconclusive. Now, I don't think that there is a distinction to be made in this case, given the number of witnesses that did give credible evidence, such as the victim's brother, who was placed in the unfortunate situation of testifying against his father to say, you know what, yeah, I saw the both of them in the room, neither of them had clothes on. We have testimony that supports all of the allegations here, and strong testimony. Under those circumstances, I don't think that there was an additional need for perhaps physical DNA evidence, as your question posed.
Did anyone ever refer to this testimony again later in the trial argument?
Are you referring to the expert's testimony?
Yes.
Other pieces of the expert's testimony were referred to, but not this statement. The statement, again, it was very minimal, and it was cut off, and a curative instruction was immediately given. Unless Your Honors have any further questions.
I do, Ms. Price. another issue that at least caused me some pause, and I apologize for, this is, it's crude, but it's in the record. This issue about when she's asked what does semen taste like. Mm-hmm. And there was an issue here on the rape shield. The defendant wanted to put on evidence that the woman had a sexual relationship that involved oral sex with the boyfriend. I guess I have two questions. What purpose was served by the prosecutor asking that question other than to suggest she wouldn't know unless the defendant here did what the defendant was accused of? So I'm curious, what other purpose was there for that question? And second, assuming that there was at least a reasonable inference that the only way she knew was because the defendant did what he's accused of, why doesn't the defendant get to put on evidence to say there's another explanation for how she would know what semen tastes like?
Well, as an initial matter, victims are allowed to testify about what happened to them. This is a part of that. As far as the prosecution's motivation for asking that question, I don't know. But this was what the victim testified happened to her, and that's valid testimony.
Did you agree that at least presents a reasonable inference here that the only reason she knew is because Dad did what Dad's accused of?
I don't think that that's the logical conclusion to that statement.
But is it a reasonable inference from that testimony?
No, I don't think it is. This, again, the victim is testifying about what happened to her. With regard to, could she have known about that based on her other boyfriend? That is simply not a cognizable exception to the rape shield statute. The exception to that statute is for determining the source of semen, and the easiest example I can think think of is perhaps when a rape kit is done, semen is found, and a defendant asserts, well, it wasn't me, it was somebody else. That is simply not the case here. This was defendant's attempt to bootstrap his way into the 16-year-old victim's history with a boyfriend. The trial court's ruling in this matter simply supported Colorado's strong policy of preventing such fishing expeditions.
Thank you.
All right. Well, with 1 minute left, if this court has any other questions, I'm more than happy to answer them. Otherwise, the people will rest on their brief and request that this court affirm Mr. Robinson's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, thank you for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course. So that.